This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on July 25th, 2013. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Commission open meeting for Thursday, July 25th, 2013 will now come to order. We have four commissioners at the table, and Commissioner Walther is participating by telephone. I apologize to everyone for the delay in starting. And despite the fact that we already had a delay, I want to take a brief moment at the beginning for two quick points of personal privilege. First of all, I want to give a shout out to Bonnie Jarrett, a terrific employee of the FEC whose last day is today. She was a paralegal at Covington and Burling and came over with Tony Herman, or shortly after Tony Herman got here, actually, to assist him in the Office of General Counsel. And she is now leaving us to go off and start her own legal career at NYU Law School, and we all wish her well. And know that she will be a really great addition to the legal profession. The other story that I wanted to share briefly is I saw this yesterday and I found it moving, so I thought, what the heck? There's so much cynicism about politicians and office holders and people in public service, and people think they're just in it for themselves. And then you read a really heartwarming story about someone like former President George H.W. Bush. I don't know whether everyone else has seen this story. A member of his security detail has a two-year-old son with leukemia. And because of the treatments, the boy's hair has fallen out, and the entire security detail and the former president all shave their heads in solidarity with this little boy and what he's going through. And this is someone who talked about wanting a kinder, gentler nation, and obviously that those weren't just words. He walks the walk. He lives those values. And I think there are a lot of people in public service who in many ways are demonstrating their own values. Sometimes people disagree about what those values should be or where people are trying to go with them. But I think it's good to remind ourselves that for most people in public office, they're in it because they want to do good for the nation and for their friends and their neighbors. And the former president gives us a really shining example of how all of us in public office should continue to bear those strong values in mind. So I thought that was a nice story, and I just wanted to share it. And the only connection I can come up with what we have before us today is that I learned about it on Twitter. And Mr. Elias, who's here today with two advisory opinion requests, is the person who first recommended that I join Twitter. So that's a very slight hook to what we have in front of us today. Thank you for your indulgence. The first item on the agenda is correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt agenda document numbers 13-28-A and 13-29, minutes for the open session held on June 27th and July 11th, right?
Yeah.
Yes, July 11th, 2013. Sorry, typo here. Sorry, July 11th, 2013.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of the minutes for the meetings of June 27th and July 11th, 2013, as set forth in agenda documents 13-28A and 1329. All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And the motion carries 5-0. We have a great many late submitted documents. Mr. Vice Chairman, do you want to just run through them all at the beginning so we can have that out of the way, or
sure. I move to suspend the rules and the timely submission of agenda documents so to consider the late submission of agenda documents numbers 13-31, 13-31-A, 13-31-B, 13-30, 13-27, and 13-21-K. Thank you very much.
Okay, I think we got all those documents in there. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? And the motion carries 5-0. The first item, this next item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-04. Mr. Elias, I feel that we're going to have some questions for you, so why don't you and Mr. Bergon join us at the table? Ms. Hayden, are you going to lead us off?
I am. Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good morning, Commissioners. Before you are agenda documents 13-31, 13-31A, and 13-31B, three alternative draft advisory opinions responding to a request from the Democratic Governors Association and Jobs and Opportunity. DGA is an unincorporated 527 political organization whose membership consists of the nation's incumbent Democratic governors. Jobs and Opportunity will be a 527 political organization whose members will consist only of DGA's executive director and its chief operating officer. Unlike DGA, no office holders or candidates will be members of Jobs and Opportunity. DGA and Jobs and Opportunity both intend to engage in federal election activity in connection with the 2014 elections. The requesters ask whether they may use non-federal funds to pay for such activity. Both drafts A and B conclude that DGA must use federal funds to pay for federal election activity, but differ with respect to Jobs and Opportunity. Draft A concludes that Jobs and Opportunity may pay for such activity using non-federal funds. Draft B concludes that Jobs and Opportunity must use federal funds to pay for the proposed activity. Draft C concludes that neither DGA nor Jobs and Opportunity are required to use federal funds to pay for the proposed activity. We received three comments on the request and no comments on the drafts. We also request authority to make technical and conforming changes to any draft that the Commission approves. Thank you, and I would be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Hyde. Well, we have, I think we missed one option. We've got two questions in front of us, and we've got one option that says yes, yes, one option that says no, no, one option that says no, yes. We don't have a yes, no. So we've almost covered the waterfront here for you, Mr. Elias, but, you know, I guess there's one possibility we're not considering. Do we have any questions for either our counsel or Mr. Elias, or comments on the drafts? Mr. Vice Chairman.
I'd like to ask, although Mr. Elias, unfortunately, haven't given you a lot of time to review draft C, which answers both questions the same way. Give you an opportunity to offer any thoughts on that draft.
Well, obviously, it is consistent with the analysis that we think is most appropriate under the statute as it was written by Congress. And under the Commission's regulations. You know, I remind the Commission that the state of play 10 years ago, prior to the passage of McCain-Feingold, there was unlimited soft money flowing throughout the party structure in all of its iterations. And I think it's easy now, 10 years later, to start with the default mindset, there is no soft money unless it's permitted. That wasn't where the law was drafted. The law was drafted against the opposite background. This started with a regime in which organizations could raise and spend money outside the federal limits, except in those instances where necessary to vindicate the policies of McCain-Feingold. And I think that it is implausible to think that the Democratic Governors Association is acting as a sort of a quasi-local party organization in lieu of the regular party apparatus, and thereby evading the state party or local party soft money rules. So I think Draft C actually gets it right. I think if you didn't go with Draft C, I honestly don't understand, under just a plain reading of the statute, how you could say no to the new organization, to J&O, because there the statute's actually pretty clear on its face. It does not impute agency. It does not impute these other concepts, which the statute does in other areas, and it just doesn't in this area. So,
The statute does talk about, though, not just state and local parties, but associations of state and local office holders. I don't have the exact statutory language in front of me, and feel free to, if you have it, to assist me in my thinking on this, on that point.
Right.
But the DGA was in existence at the time of McCain-Feingold. McCain-Feingold certainly changed how parties are to operate. And in the interest of avoiding the obvious move, which would be to sort of change the sign on the door of the local party committee to the non-party local party committee, so therefore beyond the reach of McCain-Feingold, they also reached out and touched what I would call caucus committees to a certain extent, maybe not all of them, but essentially it was a way to avoid the thorny issue of the end around the McCain-Feingold restrictions on state and local parties with respect to federal election activity. Because if one could just go from the local party headquarters across the street to the caucus committee and do the same activity, that controlled by the same politicians who were also on the state ballot for federal office, that would seem to just be a law that wouldn't really have much bite. So you have a lot of this anti-circumvention stuff pushing what happened in McCain-Feingold. Given that the DGA was organized at the time of McCain-Feingold, is it your view that this statute, when passed, was designed either expressly or through the what some call the spirit of McCain-Feingold to reach the DGA and its co-equal, it's sort of a similar situation, a similar organization on the other side of the RGA, or was it less than clear? What's your thought on
that? Yeah, I don't think so. I think it was actually, and this is just my own, you know, my own views, obviously. I haven't surveyed all of the legislative history. We've looked at some of it. But my own recollection is that what they were principally worried about, Commissioner, is exactly what you articulated, which was they wanted to put these meaningful restrictions on state and local party organizations. If you didn't also put them on the parallel state and local organizations like caucus committees that already were largely controlled, as you say, by the same people in the same states doing roughly the same activity, then you would have this gaping hole. I mean, the truth is, you know, I don't think this was contemplated at national organizations that where the association is not intrastate but is actually interstate.
Well, picking up on that, what's the difference between a caucus committee? And so people understand what I'm saying. Caucus committee is sort of like a state legislative version of DCCC or the NRCC. You know, you have a sort of a association of state office holders have their own campaign committee to worry about their own elections. Why the federal government cares about that is a whole other topic as to whether that is something the federal government can get into or not, I don't know. But why is the DGA and the RGA not that? I understand it's much more of a national organization, but it still is state office holders having, to me, what looks like to be the same sort of caucus committee that I think McCain-Feingold clearly reaches.
Because they're not, acting as proxies for state and local party apparatus, and as a result, they're not engaged in the kinds of FEA activities that we were worried. Those of us who were involved in this, you know, and the supporters of McCain-Feingold, what was being focused on was not organizations that are purely non-federally focused. The concern was that you were going to have not, it's exactly as you say, Commissioner, there was an anti-circumvention concern that if you didn't govern organizations that could easily be, a local congressman could just go to the local caucus committee in their congressional district or the local unregistered Democratic or Republican organization, and if you didn't have it, you'd have circumvention of those rules. The DGA and the RGA don't operate in federal elections. I mean, they it's not their mission. There's no history. And one of the things that I think 10 years later that this commission can take cognizance of, you know, is that you stayed relatively silent on this. You could have in 2003 specified how to read this ambiguous provision. And the commission decided not to, and I think it decided not to because it wanted to live with this. It wanted to see sort of how did this all shake out? What would these various players look like? What would the national parties look like? What would DJRJ look like? What would the state parties look like? And you now have 10 years of experience under your belt, and at the risk of wading into other items which I don't wish to wade into, this commission doesn't need to be blind to that history. The commission can look at how have these organizations operated over the last 10 years. Is there, in fact, a circumvention problem? And if there's not, then frankly, something that was meant as an anti-circumvention provision to an anti-circumvention provision really shouldn't capture, I would argue, in an ambiguous statute more than it absolutely has to. Because Congress didn't intend to federalize all campaign finance. We could have a long-spirited debate whether Congress could have just imposed a uniform system of campaign finance from president to dog catcher, but it didn't do that. And I think that you can use your experience in drawing these tougher lines now, 10 years later, to realize, okay, this is not a problem. This is not a place where we have circumvention going on, and we can make sure we're not capturing more than we have to.
On the one hand, you're saying the DGA doesn't do the sort of FEA that McCain-Feingold is concerned about. But on the other hand, you're here asking for an AO that asks about how we pay for FEA.
Right. Yeah, so when I said concerned about,
the DGA does FEA, federal election activity,
though,
proposed
conduct,
the
proposed conduct, though, is going to not be, let's turn over DGA to really help Senate elections or House elections or presidential elections. When I say it doesn't do the kind of FEA, Congress was looking to regulate federal election activity. And it had to decide how much broader to draw that. I mean, those of us who counseled clients prior to that knew that the old law erred in one direction, which was it was going to be under-inclusive. The new law was going to be slightly over-inclusive. But it was always aimed at getting the kinds of activity that influence federal elections, that are aimed at influencing federal elections. And honestly, the DGA is committed, as the RGA is, to electing Democratic and Republican governors. It wishes well its other committees, but that's what it focuses activity on. And there's no history. When I say you can look back to the last 10 years, where is the instance where the DGA or the RGA is, in fact, operating as a proxy for a federal election? You just don't see it.
Well, because McCain-Feingold stopped them from doing that. They sort of, which brings me to my next topic. I think at the time McCain-Feingold was passed, it did reach the DGA and the RGA. That was my view at the time, and that it does go. I like your word. You're kind of over-inclusive. It really pushed the anti-circumvention idea to. It's, I think, maximum. But two questions. First, why couldn't a state caucus committee make the same exact argument you're making on behalf of the DGA and claim that, well, they're not really going through the back door to influence federal elections, so they should also not be covered under the statutory provision?
Look,
I guess they could.
They could.
Some have successfully done that, in my view, but
they could,
and that would be
an AO for another day. Right. I also point out that I don't think the FEC, I don't think Congress, I don't think this commission wishes to target, for example, joint fundraising efforts between two non-federal candidates. I don't think you wish to target two non-federal campaigns, to a mayor and a state legislator having their campaigns work together to do voter turnout. I mean, there's all kinds of places where if you read this statute one way, you are going to capture an enormous amount of activity that nobody intended to be covered, and this agency won't want to cover. No one on this commission, I project, would want to cover that. So I think you have to scale this back to a place where, as Draft C says, what's going on here, where 10 years later we can look and say, let's interpret this in a way. And after all, the reason why we have federal agencies is to take bare-bone statutes that are passed at moments in time and put meat on the bones in light of the real-world experience, in light of the expertise that each one of the five of you bring to this. And I think you can look back on those 10 years and bring the expertise that says, you know what, this is not one of those provisions where we need to throttle up, we can throttle back. We don't need to regulate more, we can regulate less.
So the DGA is really more of an association of state candidates. It's not a free-floating pseudo-party committee. It's actually more akin to a candidate for mayor working with a candidate for city council, and that's something clearly beyond the reach of federal law. And if the gubernatorial folks want to get together and figure out how to elect more of their own kind to governor's seats, that's actually more candidate-to-candidate kind of things, which McCain-Feingold doesn't touch at the state and local level.
It's, I could make the argument that we're actually better. We're actually an easier question than that because we're in interstate, not intrastate. And if you were going to focus on where the concern might be, you'd actually might focus more intra than inter. But again, that's an opinion. That's a question for another day.
Has the DGA made any changes since the passage of McCain-Feingold that would make it different than? Let's assume, for the sake of argument, let me give you the assumption that McCain-Feingold does reach the DGA and RGA as they were constituted at the time of passage. So 10 years ago, whatever they look like, they do come within the reach of the statute. Has the DGA done anything since then that would bring it outside of the reach of that?
Assuming the statute
reaches it in the first.
Commissioner, I'm not sure I know the answer to that. I mean, obviously, we have seen a vast evolution of the campaign finance system from federal, non-federal committees to 527s to super PACs, and along the way, I need to think about that. I don't know the answer to that.
And that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Let me follow up on this first question and just focus on DGA for the moment. Because I'm not sure that I'm getting this, why it matters whether it's an intrastate or interstate organization. I mean, it seems to me that in order to say, yes, DGA can use non-federal funds for federal election activity, we would have to say that the Democratic Governors Association is not an association of candidates for state office. On its face, how could the Democratic Governors Association, governors being state office holders, not be an association of candidates for state office?
So the reason why I focus you on the intrastate versus interstate is that if you go back again to the policy purpose of this provision, you could envision a concern. And again, like I said, question for another day whether it's in light of history ever came to bear, but you could envision a concern that if you had the Smith County Democrats or the Smith County Republicans, and there was a congressman or a senator who exercised a lot of control over that, that what would happen is they would just create the Smith County Association of Chairs, or the state legislators of Smith County, and that it would essentially operate to do federal election activity and evade the soft money restrictions on state and local parties. This was really a provision aimed at preventing circumvention of state and local party rules. So that's why intrastate, you could see what they were getting at, is you'd have these unregulated things that would be proxies for. The fact is, DGA and RGA and the other national organizations, that's just not a practical risk. And not only am I saying that it's not a practical risk, I'm saying that 10 years later, this commission can look back and see that just isn't the history. There isn't history of RGA and DGA and other organizations like them doing this activity.
Well, maybe Congress was concerned about something that they didn't need to be concerned about. It's not my call as to what Congress should have been concerned about. But to even get into that analysis, I would first have to conclude there's something ambiguous about the phrase "association of candidates for state office" in 441 IB1. I mean, because if we conclude that the Democratic Governors Association is, I mean, it's a longer phrase, I'm just picking out the salient words, but if we conclude that the Democratic Governors Association is an association of candidates for state office or of individuals holding state office, why would we can't even get into this whole intrastate, you know, what were they thinking of, what were they worried about? It would be just barred, for whatever Congress in its infinite wisdom just barred that on its face.
So, Commissioner, I respectfully, Madam Chair, have to disagree. The role of an agency is to take the language that Congress gives you and put meat on the bones. The fact is Congress also said that you were to regulate paid communications made in coordination, cooperation, or consultation with candidates, and yet this agency on several occasions defined that not to include things that are done in coordination, consultation, or cooperation with candidates outside of 90 days if they don't include express advocacy, or within 90 days if they don't, 120 days for presidential election, 90 days, you know what I mean.
I know exactly
and that's,
what you mean.
But that's okay, but that was perfectly appropriate. I supported those rulemakings, and I supported the approach, the common sense approach the commission took there. And the courts supported the common sense approach the commission took there, notwithstanding an equal argument you could make. Well, how could this agency do anything other than, say, coordination with a candidate? It's because agencies are given discretion to take statutes, words on a page, and to flesh them out in light of the reality of what they regulate. And this
agency, with all due respect, Mr. Elias, if the statute says blue candidates can't do this, I shouldn't say blue because that actually, I was trying to come up with something that didn't have a reference and it does. fuchsia candidates can't do X. And we have a fuchsia candidate. We can't say, oh, it's not really fuchsia. Maybe it's chartreuse. I don't know. Maybe colors are too much of a question of perception. I shouldn't have gone down that road. I shouldn't have started.
I take it back. I could probably say that.
Yeah, you probably could. My point is, I think if the words are sufficiently plain on their face, I don't see any wiggle room in association or similar group of candidates for state or local office or of individuals holding state or local office. I don't know how to read those words in a way that does not include a bunch of governors.
Commissioner, I at the risk of doing something you're never supposed to do, I'm going to answer a question with a question. I don't understand then why the commission in 2003 said we're not going to define it. We're going to let things play out. I mean, if it is just black and white and it's just as clear as day, and there is no ambiguity and there's no role for the agency to play, why did you put out a rulemaking soliciting comments for it? Why did the commission say it got no comments, and why did the commission say it wasn't going to define it at that time?
Maybe because everybody thought it was perfectly obvious.
That isn't actually what the commission said in its E&J, and I don't think it's obvious. I think it is no more obvious what a association of state and local parties is than whether or not coordination with a candidate is not temporally limited.
You are bringing up such a hornet's nest with coordination, Mr. Elias. Don't go there. But let me put it this way. With respect to, there may be circumstances in which an association of some group of people, there might be some ambiguity as to whether they fall into this definition, but I am having a very hard time figuring out how a group of governors, by any stretch of the imagination, isn't an association of individuals holding state office. They are. They are individuals holding state office. The Association of Democratic Governors is an association of people holding state office. I think there's a much more complicated analysis for the second part, but this one seems pretty black and white to me. I just don't see anything in there that talks about interstate or intrastate, and, you know, we could get off on a whole frolic on whether intrastate poses more risks of corruption or interstate poses more risk of corruption, and whether it poses the risk of corruption or that was actually, you know, came to pass. But I think all of that is really irrelevant.
I will offer only one final thought, and obviously the commission will vote as it sees it. I think if that is in fact the approach you are laying out, then mayors, governors, dog catchers, sheriffs all around America ought to know that. Because I'll tell you from my standpoint, the next time I see a Republican sheriff and a Republican state legislator raising money together and coordinating their field program, they're office holders, there are two of them, they're an association, FEC said plain as day. And I just don't think that you can divorce the policy of what it is the Congress was trying to do and ask this agency to implement and say, well, we don't have to do any of that because it's just plain. And I think that that's just, that would be, a, that's an unfortunate result that we will go down, but I don't think it's plain. And I think if it was plain, then the Federal Electric Commission in 2003 should have said, this is plain on its face and this is what it means.
Well, I guess maybe I didn't understand what you were saying about the joint fundraisers before, but now I do. I would say in response to that, that I could see that there could be some ambiguity about a one-time, whether an association is formed by two non-federal candidates who come together for the purpose of one event. Maybe that is an ambiguous question, but the DGA is not a transitory, you know, or the RGA, it's not, you know, there's... doesn't make a difference. It's not a transitory grouping of folks who happen to be in the same room at the same time for, you know, one day and one day only. They've got a long history and ongoing. If the Democratic, I mean, it seems to me that what you're arguing is the Democratic Governors Association. I mean, you're not arguing that they're not Democrats. You're not arguing that, although that's not relevant here. You're not arguing that they're not governors and therefore state office holders. What you're arguing, I think, is that it's not an association. And it's hard for me to follow how an ongoing entity that calls itself the Democratic Governors Association isn't an association.
I think the question is, what does that phrase mean? What does this phrase mean for purposes of the Federal Election Campaign Act? I mean, you're not asking me what it means for purposes of state law. You're not asking me what it means for purposes of corporate governance law. You're not asking me. The question is, what does it mean for purposes of the Federal Election Campaign Act or the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act? And Congress left that to you to decide. Now, you could have passed a rule that said, we're just going to say whatever is an association under state law is an association.
Defer to state law. There's an interesting argument. You might want to make that some other time today.
But I'm just saying that I don't think that that's where the commission has left it, and I don't think that's the only alternative for you with this phrase. Because again, you know, honestly, there are plenty of places in America where, at the very local level, there are joint committees. I don't mean joint fundraising committees like you think of it. I mean like two people running for local office, for school board, they just form one, they open one bank account because they're going to raise like, you know, $6,000-$7,000, put up some yard signs, do GOTV, do voter registration, do voter turnout. And if you're saying they open a bank account, they're an unincorporated association for state law because they didn't incorporate, that they're an association of state candidates, then, you know, I just think it's more complicated than that. The commission can go either way. If it was a simple question, I wouldn't have needed to ask it. So I'm not here to say this isn't complicated or this isn't a hard question, but I think it is a complicated and hard question. I don't think it's simple either way because there isn't a bright line test here. And I think if you're not going to go in the what was Congress trying to do and what is the experience of the agency as to where the harms are, then I think you're going to have case by case one way or the other. And I think policy is probably the right way for an agency to go, but you could obviously do it a different way.
And not to belabor the point, but again, I think, you know, your two local office holder example is not what we have in front of us today. And maybe that's an interesting question, and maybe that is an ambiguous question, but I'm having a hard time finding the ambiguity about the Democratic Governors Association, which is the organization that's in front of us today. But I think you and I have said about all that we can say on that subject. I should see whether somebody else wants to talk to you about something more interesting. Commissioner Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think of the two questions that you ask, I think the DGA is the tougher. I think that the jobs and opportunity is actually the easier, because in that instance we can just look at the plain language of the statute. The concept of agency was incorporated into the statute in several specific instances to apply to several specific entities. But it was not applied to associations of state and local candidates. And, you know, there can be arguments made to, you know, well, the purpose of the statute was to try to prevent circumvention and parades of horribles can be reeled out about what this might mean. But I think that's all beside the point, that the statute says what the statute says. And in this instance, there's a lack of, I think, what isn't said is what's most relevant here. And I think for that reason, since the statute doesn't speak to what about associations that are established by these associations of state and local candidates, I think that the proposal with respect to the Jobs and Opportunity organization, I think, is permissible under the Act. Under that same line of thinking about plain language of the Act, I understand the chair's concerns because, and I think as you acknowledged in your original request, there's really not a lot of legislative history on this matter, and knowing the thoroughness with which you approach your craft, if there were something out there, you would have. I know we would have had it before us, and I wasn't aware of it, and you know I was living that back in those days, and so we are left with trying to decipher, you know, what was the underlying. In this instance, there are some appeals to purpose, and you do make a structural argument about where it's placed. That maybe we can derive some meaning from that. I'm having the same problems that the chair is about the language and, you know, association of candidates for state or local office. That this would seem, just on a pure plain language application, seem to apply to this. Let me ask though. The advisory opinion process, we can't, I mean, it's very specific in our Act that we cannot, you know, we cannot make new rules of law. And from what I understand from what you're saying, that the commission, and I wasn't here back in 2003, the commission didn't decide to define this term back at that particular time. Under what I'm hearing you say, Since it, this term really isn't, it hasn't been defined, it's vague, it's ambiguous, we don't really know what it means, and if we try to put flesh on the bone in this advisory opinion process, then what this means for DGA may also have application to the sheriff and the dog catcher who work together. Is it your argument that we shouldn't really even be, I mean, if we were to make an application one way or another, are we, in essence, making a rule that we shouldn't be making in an advisory opinion process?
I think that the commission shouldn't put folks in the catch-22 of you didn't do it in a rule, and therefore you can't do it in AO, and therefore there's no way to get an answer. So I do urge the commission to answer the questions. I do think that you should be careful in how, if you're going to say no to question one, I think you should be careful to do as little damage to other, you know, the sheriff and the dog catcher. I think that, candidly, everything that the chair said about question one compels the result in question two, which is that if, in fact, this is just, let's just read the statute for what it says, and let's leave purpose aside. And what is the plain language of the statute? There is no way to read the statute or the regulation to give me a no on question two. None. You have to immediately jump from the statute to, yes, 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 but in common law agency, and yes, no, 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 but in this other section. If you just read the statute and you read the regulation just as plainly as fuchsia and purple, okay, Madam Chair, then question two is self-evidently yes.
I agree with that. I think when we do on both questions, just take a straightforward certainly. And I think the easier of the questions is the second of the two. And for that reason, I have no problem with that. Just to go back to what you were saying about if we were going to say no, that we'd need to make sure that it didn't cut further than it needed to create unnecessary difficulties in the future. Just from your, I just want to give you a chance to respond to that, whether or not you think that the analysis with respect to DGA in, I guess it would be draft A, whether or not it indeed cuts too broad. I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are.
Honestly, I didn't see anything specific, but I'm not faulting the agency, but we got these all sort of in a rush, and I've been sort of preparing to answer, you know, to be prepared for two AOs today, so I have not looked through it that thoroughly with that frame in mind, but I'd be happy to.
All
And I apologize that we did get these to you fairly late in the day, and that's because we had four very interesting questions on the agenda today, and I think in some ways this is the hardest of all of them. It's the only one that generated three drafts. Obviously, we were considering every permutation of your question, but you are correct that we gave you very little notice, and I'm sorry for that. We try to do better.
No, and I wasn't complaining.
No, I know. But I do. You know, we try, and I think we all take that to heart. That it's a little bit unfair to folks like you and to anybody else who might want to comment on the drafts to be dropping them at the last minute. So, we strove to get it out sooner, but we failed.
I understand.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. I think my view of the language in draft A with respect to question one is it's drafted to not reach beyond what we're talking about today, which is the DGA and the RGA. It does rely on just plain statutory language, and so there's no language in there that could possibly be read to reach any of the other examples that requesters counsel has set forth. And you're right. If you live by the sword, you die by the sword. If the statute is clear, then it's clear. And with respect to the jobs and opportunity folks, as I understand the facts, that's not run by candidates, right?
It is an association of two members who are not, two individuals, neither of whom are candidates.
Neither of them are candidates.
Correct.
And they
make
the decisions?
Correct.
Okay. They don't hold state or local office?
They do not.
Okay. So you have a group of two individuals who are not candidates for state or local office. And they're not individuals holding state or local office. So under the plain language of the statute, you're right, there is only one conclusion, and that is that the JNO is not an association or similar group of candidates for state or local office or of individuals holding state or local office. They're beyond the act, in my view. So I think, that being said, I think draft A, in my view, ends up getting it right. It's I think internally consistent. I hear the argument on DGA could possibly not be within the act. Unfortunately, I think I disagree, but I appreciate you at least helping me think it through. And you know, that's, draft C was out there to at least provide a basis to have the discussion. But given that we are I think in agreement on what the statute actually says, there really can't be an agreement as to what it says, because it says what it says. I think support draft A.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about JNO, because you and I have engaged already on DGA. So let's talk about JNO. There is certainly something appealing about draft A and its statutory analysis, and here's where I get a little bit hung up. When you have any organization, it can only act through the human beings that are, in some sense, part of that organization. Officers, directors, managers, employees. I mean, organizations organizations can't write something down. Organizations can't do federal election activity. They can't. An organization doesn't, it's not this blob out there that's the organization that's going out door to door and trying to get people to vote or doing the other GOTV. It's got people that does that. So, in some way, I think the argument that, well, it doesn't say that agents of the organization will implicate the conduct of the organization, so therefore the organization has this existence independent of any of its employees and agents, and their conduct can't be imputed to the organization. How else would the organization, how else would the association act other than through the people that work for it?
Which association?
See where I'm going?
Which association?
Well, at this point, well, DGA, actually.
Yeah, but there are two associations.
Right.
Right? There's Association One, which I hear loud and clear, you believe to be an association of state office holders.
Right.
Or state candidates.
Right.
There's Association B, which, looking at state law, which I was just told to do, is an association of two people
that's
who are not
other AO.
Who are I was just told with respect to question one that I'm supposed to look at state law. It's an association of two people, neither of whom are state and local office holders. So which association do you want me to look at? What draft B seems to be saying is what we should do is look at the relationship between association between the members of Association One and Association Two. And that's agency. I get that. That may be established finance, maintaining control. I get that. Those are both useful concepts. I counsel on them every day. Neither of them are found any place near the provision we're talking about.
Well, they're found near it. They're just
yes, they're found near enough to be clear that Congress didn't intend for them to cover this. Because if Congress wanted to, Congress knew how. And in fact, this agency at the outset resisted the idea that we're just going to have common law agency. Remember the apparent authority?
Oh, yeah.
Right? We weren't going to do that. We were just going to take the law as Congress wrote it, and we were going to apply agency as Congress intended it, and here we are. And I just
Some of us were more sympathetic to the apparent agency argument, so you might want to be careful where you go there.
I just know what the four votes of the commission was. So, I mean, the commission rule, it can't be that we now, years later, have imported agency into a provision of the act where there is where Congress expressed no interest in agency. Congress expressed no interest in established finance, maintain, and control. Those are concepts where Congress wanted to express its will. It did so directly and clearly, and I'm having a hard time. I meant to just clarify the question: which of the two associations are you saying operate through their employees? They each are two separate legal organizations.
They are. I get that they're two separate legal organizations, but if it is true, and maybe it isn't, but if it is true that Organization 2 or Organization B is a is an alter ego of Organization A, that everything they do is controlled by Organization A, and it is run by people who are answerable to Organization A.
Then under what provision of the Act? I alter ego under what provision of the Act? I mean, I just honestly, Commissioner, are we going under established finance, maintain, and control, which is in another section of the Act not applicable here? Are we going under agency, which is in another provision of the Act not applicable here? Are we going under common law agency, which is what I assumed based on the reading it was resurrecting itself, having been voted down by the commission? And boy, that's a troubling development if we are now. If this agency in 2013 is now revisiting the fundamental underpinnings of that, then that ought to be put out to a rulemaking. Because I feel like a lot of water has gone under that bridge. So I'm just trying to figure out alter ego under which. Is it under a statutory provision that we're drawing an analogy to? Is it under common law agency? Alter ego under what?
I guess we're left with common law agency.
Are we going to appoint common law agency to fundraising solicitations? Establish finance, maintain, and control? Soft money solicitations? Coordination? I mean, or are we just doing common law agency in this one provision of the Act? The one place where it didn't say agent is where we're going to put common law agency, having rejected it in the places where we actually speak about agents.
Let me make sure that we have the facts right, okay? I'm interested in your reaction to the description in draft B of the facts and whether you think that they are not true. And I'm looking at page 5, where it says, the proposal described by the requesters suggests that the association will have complete control of jobs and opportunity. Although the requesters describe these organizations as separate, the request states that jobs and opportunities two members are officers of the association, DGA, namely the association's executive director and chief operating officer. The group of persons that will decide how J&O spends its money will include association officers and other association employees. Other association employees are likely to play a role in the day-to-day operations of J&O, and it's possible that the association will provide funds to J&O. Moreover, the requesters assert that members of the association, the nation's Democratic governors, will generally not play a role in deciding how job and opportunities funds are spent or in its day-to-day operations in order to comply with state law prohibitions against coordination. This caveated representation suggests that association members will indeed play such a role when state law does not so prohibit. Now, if the draft is operating on erroneous assumptions in any of those regards, I would really like to, I think that would be an important thing to make clear.
I think it's operating under an erroneous assumption in its first sentence. Under state law, which is what I'm now looking to, an association is controlled by its members. It has two members. That's who controls the association. Now, that is, if you have a different notion of what control means, but if we're looking at just who has the formal authority to bind the organization, to speak in the organization's name, to direct the organization, to dissolve it, to ensure its compliance with law, it is the members. And those are two individuals who are not elected officials they're not federal elected officials, they're not state elected officials, they're not office holders. So it is therefore an association. By definition, it's an association of two people. So I don't, when you say the proposal described by the requester, I shouldn't say you, when the draft just says that is an association, that the association will have complete control over jobs and security, by what measure are we saying?
Jobs and opportunity. Jobs and security might be some
other. Sorry, jobs and opportunity. By what measure are we saying that? Under what standard is that being asserted? I don't see a cite.
Well, it's a factual question. That's why I'm asking you about it. As a factual matter.
As a formal factual matter? It's not a factual matter. It's a legal matter, right? As a legal matter. They're two different organizations.
Well, they're two different organizations, but the entire membership of one organization appears to be the executive director and chief operating officer of another organization.
Absolutely.
So if they are in all of their decision making on behalf of jobs and opportunity, actually operating at the instructions of the DGA, that might be troubling to some people.
It could. I don't know why it would be troubling, but more importantly,
I mean, it's not troubling in that there's nothing wrong with it in the broader sense, but in the sense of who is making the decisions for this organization, who is really making the decisions for this organization.
Honestly, Commissioner, I am rarely befuddled, but I have to say I am confused. If the question is it an association of state and local candidates or office holders, the answer is no. I think that's actually a factual question. I don't think there's a dispute. If your question is now, are there people who are state office holders who have influence over, or who run an organization who employ people, or are members of an organization that employ people who control, okay, but where is that in the statute? Where is that any place in the statute? I mean, that's an analysis, again, we use a sort of similar, but not exactly same analysis in other parts of McCain-Feingold, where either establish, finance, maintain, or control is referenced, or where agency is referenced, and those are defined terms. I don't understand within the existing regulation what this draft points to as the legal authority to say, maybe you need a new rule, maybe you need a new rulemaking. But under the having been regularly told by various commissioners of all stripes and political persuasion and party that I shouldn't come here for rules, I should come here for advisory opinions. If you want a rule, make a rule. But this current set of rules doesn't import any of those concepts.
So let's take a hypothetical. Not saying this is necessarily what's happening, but hypothetically, let's suppose these two individuals, before they make every single decision that they make on behalf of J&O, they go back to their bosses at DGA and they say, what do you want us to do about this? And they are given explicit instructions in every instance on what they should do in every aspect of the operations of J&O. Would it be your position that would be okay?
Absolutely, not even a close call. I mean, what if the Smith for Governor campaign manager, an association under state law, every day it goes back to the governor or the gubernatorial candidate and says, I want to make this decision on doing GOTV. Does that mean they're regulated by the Federal Election Campaign Act? No. So this was a very, very narrow carve-out from a basic proposition, which is you're going to have organizations operate at the state and local level, and we're not federalizing their activity. We are only going to federalize the activity where it is an association of the state and local office holders. The fact that it's an organization that seeks input to, is responsive to, has interaction with, all of, by the way, are highly constrained in the actual facts here by the fact that there are anti-coordination rules in most states. So in fact, in most of these places, what you're describing, in fact, under because of state law, can't happen. But let's just play your hypothetical through. Let's assume that all of America repealed its campaign finance laws other than the Federal Election Commission. There would be absolutely nothing wrong with the hypothetical you just listed. Not one thing under this, under McCain-Feingold as it's written. I understand the policy you're trying to get at, but having just been told that we're not looking at the policies behind these laws, and we're just looking at the plain text of the law, because if you look at the policy, DGA doesn't belong in this at all. But if we're now going to start looking at the policies, if we're going to just look at the plain text, I don't understand how under that hypothetical it's a close question. What am I just feel like I'm missing something in this. How are they an association of state candidates or office holders?
Well, my point is that I think it comes to whether the words on the page are ambiguous or not. I don't.
Now, association of state candidates is ambiguous?
No, not as applied to DGA. I don't think there's any ambiguity at all. But okay. And those aren't actually the words that I'm talking about. I'm talking about the parenthetical. When it says we're not reaching agents, I'm not sure how that actually can be true in process, in practice, because I don't think organizations can function other than through their agents.
Correct. And J&O will operate through its agents. Absolutely. It'll operate through its agents in the same way that that oil organizations operate through their agents. But the fact that J&O operates through its agents doesn't mean that it's an association of state.
No, that's not my concern. My concern is that the members of J&O are agents of DGA.
True. Absolutely. And if we had agency as a concept in this section of the act, we'd be having a whole conversation like the Montana state party chair who was wearing this hat and wearing that hat. We'd be having a whole, this whole draft would have a whole multiple hat section piece of it. But we don't have a multiple hat. So you didn't cite the Montana, you didn't cite Rory Reed. We didn't get into that because, I assume, because no one in the general counsel office could find any possible way that those AOs and the sections they cite to somehow tie to this provision. So you kind of skipped over that, not you, the general counsel, just sort of skipped over that whole analysis and just went straight to the, we're just going to apply sort of common law agency.
Well, in all honesty, don't blame the general counsel, because I asked them to draft this because I wanted to see how it would play out. We often do that. We say, what's the best argument for a particular
answer? Okay, and I apologize.
So, don't blame them.
Commissioner, can I just add one piece of legislation? If you look at page 49083, Federal Register, volume 67, number 145, Monday, July 29th, Title I of BCRA refers to agents in order to implement specific provisions and limitations with regard to particular enumerated activities on behalf of specific principals. I mean, the commission could not have been clearer that agents was because of specific provisions of the law with specific limitations regarding to particular activities with enumerated activities. I mean, the commission walked this road already, and I don't see how absent a rulemaking, how we put agency into this provision of the law in light of where the commission was.
And I guess my concern is whether any of the provisions of the law, that this law or any law that doesn't specifically reference agency, would have any real meaning if all an organization that was itself limited had to do to avoid its limitations is to set up a subsidiary and put its own employees in charge of it and tell them to do it all through the second organization.
And that's a fair point. And let me maybe double back to where I started.
Okay.
We are starting in a mindset, which I think is not correct, which is in 2013, we're looking back and starting with the world starts with all hard money unless there's an allowance for soft money. In 2003, there was all soft money. And the question was, what is being cut back? What are we taking away?
I actually, just not to interrupt you, but I don't know how anybody in 2013 can think that, you know, the world starts with all hard money. There is so much soft money in the system.
Fair point. But my point about when we read the regulations, we start with sort of a default around a sort of a presumption of hard money, and then unless there's an exception to it. And in 2003, this was a novel idea that we were going to regulate a lot more real estate than had ever been regulated. I mean, this was, if what we've seen in the last 5 years, in many respects, very regrettably, has been a retreat of the courts and other, due to the courts, not due to this agency, but due to the courts, has been a sort of a cutting back on real estate. This was a huge, huge leap of grabbing and regulating a lot more than had ever been regulated before. So I don't know why you find it surprising that they chose not to regulate, not only that they were going to regulate associations, but not then also impose agency requirements there. I mean, imposing agency requirements have, as this commission knows from a whole line of other AOs, you wind up with signage at events, you wind up with additional disclaimers. I mean, it has a lot of consequences getting imposing agency. And this would have been a fairly dramatic leap forward anyway, and not leaping even further forward, I don't think reflected I think that's actually pretty understandable.
But if there is consensus, which I think there may be, that DGA has to operate under certain restrictions, do those restrictions have any meaning at all?
Sure.
If they can just set up another organization and say, okay, we're just going to, you know, create a new corporation or a new association and have two of our guys running it, and they'll do whatever we tell them to do.
Absolutely. I mean, if it had no consequences, I wouldn't have been here discussing question one with you. If it was all the same, right?
So what are the consequences?
It means that the, assuming the commission vote is going the way it sounds like it is, so I'm not conceding this, but I'm recognizing it. If you assume that it is, that DGA is an association of Democratic office holders for purposes of the Federal Election Campaign Act, then it means that DGA as an association of state office holders can't do this activity. That there is another organization which the elected officials or the governors are not members of that is doing the activity. That has consequences. It has a lot of practical consequences. It may not have as many consequences as some might want. It may not kill the organization, may not destroy the program, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have consequences. If it had no consequences, then you know, frankly, I'd say I wouldn't have needed the first question. I mean, the governors are giving up, Mr. Burkhardt points out, the governors are giving up a tremendous amount of authority in this. This organization is going to be run by, there are two individuals who will control this organization legally. And that, you know, if I told you you could take your individual bank account and give it to someone else who works for you and put it in their name, have you not given up anything, have you given up nothing? Right, just because the person you've given it to, you trust, you think will do a good job, you'll talk to, you'll have input with within the law, you think there's been no practical impact? Of course, there's been a practical impact. DGA is no longer controlling it is no longer the governor's association that is doing this program. It has impacts on disclaimers and who's associated with the, you know, who's getting public credit for the activity. It has lots of practical consequences.
Can DGA fire these two individuals from their position at J&O?
I'd have to look at state law. I don't know how. I assume not. I mean, I don't think there's a way for a. I don't believe that that the members of a association are fired by. I mean, they're the members. Not that I know of, but and they'd be fired from their DGA's position.
Right. Can DGA dissolve JNO?
I play a little bit of state law lawyer. I believe that for a state association to dissolve, I believe it's dissolved by the members.
Are these two individuals deriving the bulk of their salaried income from DGA or from JNO?
Well, right now, since...
Right now, JNO doesn't exist.
Right now, JNO doesn't exist.
Because that's a lot of sway if you're, basically controlling something.
I'm not hiding from sway. If I were in a world of multiple hats, we'd be having all kinds of conversations about sway. Whether the chief of staff, for example, to a congressman in Montana could realistically put down that hat and raise money. We'd have all kinds of conversations about that. I'm not in that world. I'm not in the multiple hat world. Yes, they'll have sway. Absolutely. And thus what? They are still not an association of state office holders. And I'm going back to I started today by trying to engage the commission in discussion of policy about what Congress was really trying to do here. And what I got, frankly, on a bipartisan basis, this is something the press ought to notice. It was a bipartisan moment. I was told, no, not interested in that.
They're not going to notice that.
Plain language.
I actually think we're going to have a lot of bipartisan moments today.
Of the statute is the plain language of the statute, and nothing you can, that's just the way it is. And now we get to question two, and it feels like policy has reemerged into the landscape. And it seems to me that if there was a plain language argument, I've got a better argument for it here than I think I lost or I'm going to lose on the first question. Because honestly, Congress knew how to say agents. They say it throughout the act. They knew how to do it, and they didn't do it here.
I hear you. Mr. Vice Chairman?
The alter ego theory, to me, factually doesn't wash here. I haven't heard anything that is actually factual that ties these organizations together as a legal matter under state law. You were hesitant to answer some of the questions, but I thought they were pretty obvious. The way I understand the facts is that JNO, we'll call it JNO, is run by two guys that don't come within the reach of the statute. Other people can't fire them. They're it.
That's correct. And Commissioner, Mr. Burgon just pointed out to me to answer that question and the chair's question. In our footnote, we point out that even if DGA terminated those two individuals tomorrow, they would still be recognized as members.
Right.
Of the organization under district Columbia law, and there is a cite to the law that says that.
It's not my place to rain on your parade politically, but the thing strikes me is maybe this will work, maybe it won't work, because you have
like so much in politics.
Right, you have a couple folks that are trying to set up something separate and apart from the DGA, and legally they have to keep it separate and apart for payroll tax purposes, I'm not using any language of the act or backdooring any sort of established, maintained finance control or any of the other words that apply to entirely different situations. I'm saying it's a practical matter under state law. It's going to be a separate deal. They work for themselves. I guess they can fire themselves. They can fire each other. But it may not work because who are these guys? I mean, I'm sure they're great. I'm sure they know what they're doing. But it's a whole separate branding operation, and it's a whole separate sales pitch to supporters and both financial and political supporters and voters and all that. So when I read Draft B, it reads a lot like some of the stuff that sometimes I see in MERS, right? Where it says, proposal described by the requester suggests that the association have complete control over jobs and opportunity. And then, well, the facts actually don't really suggest that. But that sidesteps the predicate legal issue, which you're making, which is so what? Right? The agency idea, for example, is agents of federal office holders or candidates because of the soft money break that McCain-Feingold tried to put in between those politicians that controlled federal policy and money And it made sense that if you could just have a federal official, otherwise covered by McCain-Feingold, say to his friend or his staffer, hey, you go ask for the money, that's an easy way around the law. So Congress thought this through and put the agency concept into that sort of thing. The idea of an agent of a state candidate somehow cannot then set up his own entity, raise his own money to pay himself, and that sort of thing is nowhere in the statute. And factually, it's nowhere to be found here. The whole establish, maintain, finance, and control, what does that have to do with a non-federal committee? That has nothing to do with the non-federal. This is an amalgamation of legal theories pulled together trying to justify a conclusion. And factually, the conclusion doesn't really wash. Now, look, if there is an issue, say a complaint is filed, and let's assume draft A passes. Assume you have an AO, but the complaint alleges facts that prove under create a reason to believe that the JNO is in fact under state law merely an alter ego of DGA, and that they really are one and the same. I don't think the AO gives you protection if factually that's true. But factually, sitting here today, it's not true. For purposes of the AO, this is a separate entity. Now, all this other stuff is speculation as to what may happen in the future, that maybe this is some elaborate deal where really they're just going to keep doing the same thing and everybody's going to switch titles. But based upon the facts as presented, that's not the case. My guess is it's not the intent to just do a title switch. This is seen as a separate deal, fraught with danger in a lot of ways. It may not work. But it seems to me that you can't just assume because somebody works at one place that all of a sudden he's not allowed to work somewhere else or start a separate entity or that kind of thing. Reminds me of actually the SpeechNow case. In the SpeechNow case, recall that SpeechNow was put together in large part by a fellow named David Keating. And prior to SpeechNow, David Keating was with the Club for Growth. And the FEC had pursued an enforcement action against Club for Growth. And in the course of the SpeechNow litigation, the FEC made the argument, very similar to some of what I'm hearing today, that because Keating worked for Club for Growth, Club for Growth dealt with federal candidates and the like, maybe the commission can make a showing in the SpeechNow case that you can still justify a contribution limit because Keating was also... Somehow Keating was tainted because he used to work for Club for Growth, and now he works for SpeechNow, and although they're separate entities because of the link with David Keating, therefore you could justify a contribution limit on SpeechNow. Court had none of that. This idea that because you work for one place and then you want to work for someplace else has no relevancy. The only area I think it does in BCRA is the folks who used to work for a party committee, they have the blackout period. And that's a coordination drives that. But the commission's been you're right. The commission's been down this road before, and I think in a lot of ways the commission's already answered the question. But to the extent the commission hasn't answered the question being voiced today, courts have answered it. The commission's already tried this argument in other contexts. The idea that somebody brings with them some sort of taint and therefore some sort of alter ego or agency or that kind of thing. It seems to me that on these facts, this is okay. This thing may not even work, with all due respect to Mr. Elias' his client.
So just to follow up on what the vice chairman was saying, so... it sounds almost as if you're assuming that there's. Are you assuming that they're severing their relationship with DGA and now they're going off and doing? No, so it's
two, over, two right? jobs. Two jobs.
And that is.
That's
accurate,
correct.
Right?
They're not severing the relationship.
But you see this all the time, right? You have a person who works on Capitol Hill, as a staffer for a member of Congress. They're also a volunteer or even a paid person for that member's campaign, right? They may even work for the leadership PAC. They wear three hats. They have separate payrolls, and they keep it separate. It seems to me that factually, that's what That's what this is, and it works there. And if it doesn't work, it's not because they had to make it all illegal. It's because somebody decides to do campaign work in the official office, or somebody decides to do leadership PAC work using campaign funds or that sort of thing. But it still has to be kept separate. And I think there is still this potential that if under state law this is really just nothing but an alter ego and you pierce the, and you say they actually really are the same entity, then potentially that could be a problem. But that's for a MER. That's not to decide the AO, which on the factual record of the AO, and looking at Mr. Elias to remind me of any additional facts that would establish the separateness of the entities. We've already hashed out some of them, but anything else with tax purposes?
I mean, look,
office space.
They're separate.
Expense reports. I mean,
right. So, this is why, Mr. Vice Chairman, I am so quiet and hesitant to. You're fundamentally correct, but here's why I'm hesitant to join this line. I don't want this to become a multiple hats analysis. Okay, this is not a question, because that gets into, that assumes that there is agency and that we are trying to contend with agency. This is unquestionably two different organizations. They have two different tax ID numbers. They have two different governing structures. They are separate organizations.
I'm not going down the agency road. Tax law.
Yeah,
And who, if J&O gets sued.
J&O gets sued.
They put up an ad and they get sued for defamation. I'm assuming they have their own. They're going to have their own separate insurance policy for that sort of thing. Apparently, you can insure against that kind of thing nowadays. It's quite expensive, but not as expensive as a lawsuit, right? I mean, all those. That's not an agency question.
Right.
That's a biz org
question.
They're
just they're separate legal organizations.
I think that the analogy that the vice chairman is positing to somebody who works for a congressional office and maybe also for the campaign and maybe also for the leadership PAC is not really relevant to my concern, because in all three of those organizations, there's really no mystery as to who's in charge. That's the member who's in charge and making the calls for all those organizations. And here,
if only all the staff agreed with that.
can I actually slightly take issue with that? I would say that if the Leadership Act, for example, is incorporated, the Leadership Act is established, finance, maintainer, controlled by the member. The Leadership PAC, people who work for the Leadership PAC are likely agents of the member to Leadership PAC. But they're two separate legal entities, and absent those concepts, this is why I keep saying you don't need to confront the question that you're confronting here in the Leadership PAC campaign, because you have agency, because you have established, finance, maintainer, control. You don't have that here, and that's why I don't want these two analyses to bleed. Because the fact is, in that case, you say it's a different fact pattern. I'd say, yes, it's a different fact pattern, because all you have to do is show that they're acting as agents of the candidate, and it's game, set, match. They can be two totally different legal corporations, two separate tax ID numbers.
Game, set, match for purposes of McCain-Feingold.
For purposes of McCain-Feingold, right. Correct.
Because of the contribution limits and the appearance of corruption and all that.
But here, let's say
there's no question in that analogy, you know, I mean, regardless of the fact that some staffers may think they're in charge, that who's making the decisions, at least theoretically, for all three organizations. And there's nothing wrong with that. So my concern here is who's making the decisions for J&O, and is it actually DGA?
DGA or DGA's members?
Well, DGA. It would have to be DGA, I think. But the vice chairman said something that sounded interesting to me, and I'm wondering whether he meant it the way I heard it, or Mr. Elias would be satisfied with it. I have a feeling it's not going to turn out. But the vice chairman suggested that if J&O was actually functioning as an alter ego of DGA, that would be different.
It could be, depending on how state law treats it, and if it ends up being the same. entity. Like, let's if there is a lawsuit and the lawsuit ends up piercing the veil and making them the same entity for purposes of liability, this is an area that I haven't had to really look at over 5 years. But it seems to me that let's make it simpler. Let's say they actually have the same tax ID number, or they really don't separate themselves, you know, or the J&O actually doesn't separately incorporate. These two guys just go off and say that, oh yeah, we're a separate deal. They don't get a separate tax ID number. They don't do all the sort of things one does when you set up an entity.
It's a special project fund instead of a separate legal entity.
Right, right. My special project fund. And it looks like it's actually a special project fund within the DGA. That's the DGA at that point. Now, so I don't know if alter ego is the correct word, because that is a word that comes up in corporate law. But what I'm saying is, if they don't do it right, they could. These guys could still be deemed a DGA if they mess up.
And I guess it is fundamentally a piercing the corporate veil theory that I'm kind of working with here. That's kind of the way I view this. It's not entirely clear to me that this is a fully separate organization. That it is, in some sense, a subset of the DGA. Now, if there were language in Draft A that said, as such, the Commission concludes that Jobs and Opportunity is not required to use federal funds to pay for the activity described in the request, comma, provided it's not functioning as an alter ego of the DGA.
I'm not sure I know what that means. I mean, I as a person who's going to read this and have to explain it, is there an alter ego regulation I can look to?
That's a concern I have.
I mean,
I like the concept makes sense, but the concern is what does alter ego? Does that mean FICA common law alter ego, or is that a state law?
Commissioner Walther, please weigh in.
He may know things on state law.
Pretty interesting conversation so far, but on the alter ego issue, it generally comes up in the case where a corporation wants to shield itself from liability in a particular state and even multiple states, and so there are sub-corporations, some of which are or not are other equals, to protect themselves from liability. But to the extent that they are truly an alter ego, then the separate, the corporate veil is set aside, so the parent corporation can be liable. I don't know if this is really what we're talking about here, but it has the same potential consequence. But the way I read the argument, last night when I read through this, it seemed fairly simple to me, and the redundancy of the idea that you can't, we often quote the adage in our own lexicon, you can't do indirectly, what you can't do directly. And that seemed to be what was being attempted here. Because the only question I had here, one thing is that J&O's members will include DOJ's executive director and its chief operating officer. Is it including, or is that it?
If that's the change we need to make, I mean, that we... I can tell you it will not include a state... Now I'm starting to lose the chain here. It will not be a state office holder or candidate. So
I'm interested in the language, because I wrote down, somebody said here, the two individuals will control this organization, and that is the DGA's executive director and the chief operating officer. That was recently, that was said a few minutes ago. So I got the impression that they are going to control it. And the people who control who they are is DGA. So you're getting pretty close to almost an unassailable agency situation. And that's what, for me, made it fairly simple. It's not like you create a trust, and you have three or four people that you know, and they become trustees. They have separate responsibilities. They have separate... duties, and they can't be terminated. They can't take your orders because fiduciary duties require otherwise. Then you see some insulation. But here I only see a direct power relationship between DGA and JNO to the executive director and the chief and the COO. And that being the case, we would have a hard time in other instances. But when we're saying, well, the corporation can't do it, and they come back and say, well, yes, but we created this little entity here where you know, the CEO and the the CFO are doing the same thing, but you can't reach them. And I think it's difficult for us, and I would think, to say, okay, our law applies to corporations, but it doesn't apply to an entity that's going to do the same thing for the corporation, and includes the CEO and the, let's say, the CFO. It just seems to me it's hardly more that, and I think we have a situation in other cases where we'd be confronted with that, unfortunately.
Do you want to respond, Mr. Elias?
Well, I mean, I think that Commissioner Walther, I think you put it fairly squarely in that if the commission believes that agency applies, then honestly, it ought to just say it. It ought not to hide behind it. And I think you ought to embrace that and let whatever consequences flow from that. The fact that you are putting a concept into a statute where it does not exist and into a regulation where it does not exist. But if that's what this is, if the commission is not going to reach a result or is going to reach an adverse result because it believes agency applies to this provision, then that is going to be of significance in a whole host of arenas, because I think it is fair to say the regulated community did not understand that agency extended outside of the statute, that there was in fact a common law agency. And I think that the commission ought to say that. I obviously don't think it's correct, and I think it poses enormous legal obstacles to this commission defending that position, or it were to be challenged. I'm not suggesting that we would challenge it, but if it were challenged, I think it would be a difficult proposition to support, but I at least appreciate the candor to it, and we ought to not rely on a settlement agreement and a MER, and I mean, we ought to say, we think it's agency, and agency applies everywhere in the Act, and then let the chips fall where it may, so in some sense, I appreciate we're actually sort of narrowing down, I think, what the issues are, which is that there is some belief that we should, that the commission should appropriately bring concepts of agency into this provision, or the provisions outside of Title I that have agency explicitly as part of the statute.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
It just seems to me it's hard to ignore the situation. I see that it's in the other parts of the statute, and it gives me pause as to why that's so if agency, if the only way that he can act is through its agents. So, I'm troubled by why we would be putting it in and not putting it in, because when it's not in, then who's acting that you can't act with impunity?
Right.
Just because it wasn't in the statute, if doing the corporation, if they're carrying out the orders of the corporation. I mean, typically, an independent contractor has a different theory than an agency does, as you know, but if you have somebody who's just directly responsible for carrying out the policy, then agency applies, it seems, automatically. But I'm trying to figure out a way to look at it from a perspective that it works here, but I'm on a hard time with it.
But Commissioner, I would just point out again, because I realize you're not here and this may be harder to do on the phone, but what we're talking about are the specific provisions that came in as part of McCain-Feingold. Okay, we're not talking about, as part of McCain-Feingold, Congress defined a new set of restrictions and defined agency applying to some of them, but not others. And then this agency went through a very, very exhaustive and exhausting rulemaking, in which it said, and I gave you the site earlier, Title I of BCRA refers to agents in order to implement specific prohibitions and limitations with regard to particular enumerated activities on behalf of specific principles. I mean, I just honestly don't think when you're talking about the type, when you're talking about part 300, which is what we're talking about, that there could have been any Congress or this agency until today could have been any clearer to anyone wanting to know whether agency in part 300 applied more broadly than to the sections where it is spelled out explicitly, because Congress didn't write it into every section and this agency then didn't write it into every section in the rulemaking. So you know, gee whiz, I mean, this is going to be, are you now saying that actually isn't the right rule? That in fact part 300 just has a general agency in all of its provisions? I just want to be clear.
We have to take a look at how things get done from a corporate perspective, and you know, it's pretty much the Hornbook law, and I don't know if that's what we want to talk about here, but that they can only be done through its agents. And here we have not just agents, but you have the executive director and the chief operating officer, and they're the ones that are delegated the responsibility to run J&L. And the language here is the two individuals will control the organization. Okay, so how much independence will they have?
Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. I don't want to cut you off, Commissioner Walther, but I put my hand up to respond. All right, let's go down the agency road just for fun. First, merely because the two folks that want to get J&O going work at the DGA does not mean they're agents of DGA at all times, 24/7, 365 days a year. Even when the commission does deal with agency, you're not always an agent for all purposes. So we can't merely presume facts that are not before us. It would require a presumption that these guys, that there's factual support somewhere, which is not in the record before us, but factual support somewhere that shows these guys are actually agents of people who are of a group that's covered under the act. I don't see the facts to support that presumption. Two, it is true in the corporate world that corporations can act only through their agents. But to me, that's not really the concept that we're talking about here. Even in the pre-Citizens United world, when corporations were banned from running independent expenditures and electioneering communications, a corporate CEO could still run the same ad that would be otherwise banned if he used the corporate treasury, even if what he had was a single-member corporation. The commission never suggested that individual was an agent of the corporation at all times for all purposes and therefore banned. And this is even in the pre-Citizens United world. Think about government contractors. If you're an individual who signs a contract with the government, you're a government contractor. If your business signs the contract, you in your individual capacity aren't necessarily subject to the ban, as I understand Hornbook law on the point. You see this throughout campaign finance law. So to back the train up, now that I've gone down the agency road, it shows that it's really a dead end street, and that it doesn't really apply in a way that would justify the answer that's suggested in draft B. It still points you to the answer that's in draft A.
Let me ask you this, though. If you have a situation, and then I don't want to get locked in the Citizens United, but a corporation decided, you know, a free Citizens United corporation can't do it, fine. Certainly, somebody can say, president, all he wants, he can use his own money and do whatever he wants. I understand that. But that doesn't mean that necessarily is acting on behalf of the corporation, but if the CEO, pre-Citizens United, or say the president, or created their own entity, and said the president of Corporation X and the CEO of Corporation X are going to be the ones to be the controlling entity. Setting aside the, where the money comes from, if the money came from the corporation, obviously you have the same problem. But I think you have to be careful about saying automatically that there's not some kind of a power relationship. Here, I don't know. Why do they have the executive director and the chief operating officer running J&O? Can somebody else run J&O? Can somebody else, other than DGA, select the people who run J&O?
If I can.
If they can, then, I mean, we can look at scenarios where that that strict agency implication doesn't apply, but the documents before us don't give us that leeway.
The flip side, though, is we can't be too quick to presume control the other direction, right? I mean, you
I agree with that.
Okay, but that's what seems to be driving, in my view, draft B, is that we are assuming this agency relationship. Let's go back to the pre-Citizens United world one more time. Let's say you had a corporation run by, I don't know, two people. Now, let's say it's not. Let's change that. Let's say there's a corporate board of five people, and there's a president of the corporation not on the board. He decides to set up an MCFL corporation so that it wouldn't be banned. Now, some might speculate in the newspapers, oh, that's the same. Seems like the same thing. That can't be right. But under the law, that's perfectly fine. The MCFL company. So assuming it complied with the MCFL hoops, the three-part test. And again, I'm going back pre-CU to illustrate the point. This is a long-standing theme of the law. Nothing precludes the MCFL company from, in the pre-CU world, and certainly in the post-CU world, from doing express advocacy merely because the guy who runs the MCFL company also works for the other company that would otherwise be banned.
I think it's a little messy when he's trying to implant that into this situation, but...
How so, though?
Where is the money coming from J&O?
Okay, that's a good question. I would second that question to Mr. Elias. Where is J&O getting any money from the DGA?
It might. I don't know. It doesn't exist yet. It might get money from the DGA. It might get money. Look, if this commission wants to analyze this, it will get money from the general public. It'll get money from any number of sources. If this is established finance, maintain, and control, or this is agency, then honestly, it's a request that needs to be. Then, frankly, I would just ask that you write that answer. I think it is fundamentally wrong, and I honestly, as a practitioner, no longer know what to do with your E&J. You know, we spend all of this time on this side of the table reading your E&J, trying to think this is what the agency's decided. And honestly, you passed some they passed a new law, you passed regulations, you put in an E&J that agency doesn't apply, and now here I am 10 years later with all of that unwinding in front of me. And honestly, it just I assume then the E&J is just kind of for the commissioners at the moment. But if this is a, are you wearing multiple hats? Is there an agency relationship here? Is there established finance management control? Then let's have that as the as another draft D, and then like I said, we'll sort of see where we go. I think the reason why none of the drafts go that route is because honestly, no one believes that looking at the text of the statute and the regs and your E&J, there is a basis to import concepts of agency from a statute that was passed all in one fell swoop. All of Part 300 came together in one piece, and some provisions have said agent, and some provisions didn't say agent. And I just honestly don't know how much clearer that could be. But I'm respectful of the commission. The commission can decide that isn't any longer true. I just think you need to just say that, though, that that's not true. And don't try to dress this up in just say that piece of the E&J is no longer operative. We just think agency applies to everything now. But you had a big discussion. I can promise you had a big discussion about that 10 years ago. And that isn't what the regulated community was told. So, you know, I don't mean to be long-winded or to be difficult about this. I just think if I were looking at Commissioners Toner, Sandstrom, Weintraub? No.
Well, I wouldn't have been here to say Sandstrom.
You know, if I this, like, they would have been advocating what you all are saying, they'd be like, Mr. Elias, we already heard that argument, and we've decided to go a different way. And read R, E, and J.
I think the issue is covered in the draft B on question number two. I don't think anything I'm saying departs from that. Now, whether it says tries to square it with the common law definition of agency, we can talk about that. But it certainly talks about who's in control, and so our conversation shouldn't come as any surprise. It came really out of the response to question two in draft B. It says, in short, the jobs and opportunities will be managed, staffed, and potentially funded by the association that's in place. Best jobs and opportunities, use of non-federal funds for federal election activity would unlawfully circumvent 441IB as a direct prohibition of the association's use of non-federal funds for federal election activity. Okay. Are we talking agency or not? I guess we can go back and forth on that, but that's the issue that... it's in my mind, but is how to construe the structure that you're proposing in a way that doesn't fall in that category.
But Commissioner, as I look at page 6 of draft B, which is where the legal authority is, none of these deal with Part 300. Not one of these deals with Part 300. And Part 300 came in as one unified section from Congress as part of McCain-Feingold. So I think squaring this with that is important for the agency. If the position is Part 300, in fact, we're just taking a new cast on it, then I think it would be unfortunate, but okay, that's what we're going to do. But I think to ignore the fact that McCain-Feingold all came in, that all of these prohibitions in Part 300 came in together, I think is a pretty glaring omission.
Well, I've got to admit, Mark, you lived that whole period in a way that I have not, but I certainly grant you that, and know the discussion on 300 is not in there, and I'm more than willing to take a look at it from that perspective. So I'm looking at it from what we've been discussing based upon our drafts.
I understand, sir.
I said maybe there's one way to add a motion on where the consensus seems to be on question number one and leave this open for further information and discussion. It's possible we could do that, I suppose.
One thought that keeps coming back to me is I think the concern here is, on my part, is not necessarily that they would be functioning as agents of DGA, that would be functioning as agents of DGA, but that it would be functionally the same entity. So what I've been sort of on the side here passing little scribbled notes back and forth with the vice chairman about is whether there is some way that we could cabin in draft A. And the language that I tossed over to him, and I get your reaction to it, was something, and this is, I'm trying to take it a step further than the language I proposed earlier, something along the lines of, the commission concludes that JNO is not required to use federal funds to pay for the activity described in the request, provided that JNO is not an alter ego of the DGA under the state law where the entities are incorporated or established. I mean, so we wouldn't be making, because it's not, part of the problem is it doesn't exist yet. So it's a little bit hard to predict exactly how it's going to function, and I suspect it will evolve. But I would be comfortable saying that, provided that the relationship between these two organizations is not so close that the corporate veil would be pierced under state law if there were a lawsuit, if there is some language that we could add to this opinion along those lines. And I think that is not your intent to have that relationship be that close, that you're trying to set up
enough
of a wall between
the only
them?
Place, the only reason why I'm looking at you somewhat blankly is I guess I have two questions, which are legal, factual questions. Maybe the general counsel's office maybe knows, maybe the commissioners know. A, I genuinely don't know. I'm not saying I don't know in the rhetorical sense. I'm saying mm-hmm. I don't know in the I don't know sense. Is alter ego actually a term? Is that a legal term, or is that a colloquialism that people use to refer to some? In other words, is there an alter ego statute in the District of Columbia that we would look to, that says what that is? I just don't know. I mean, I'd be happy to look at the language, but I don't know what the.
I hear you, and the Vice Chairman is suggesting that case law would be determinative, but maybe you're right. Maybe alter ego is not the right phrase, but that, I think, and I'll call on you in a second, Mr. Vice Chairman, that, I think, perhaps lends support to Commissioner Walther's suggestion that maybe we should answer the part that we can answer and hold the second one for a little bit more consideration, if that's all right with you, to see if maybe we could come up with a proposal that would satisfy us, and then we would obviously put it out for public comment, including yours, to make sure that you understood it. Commissioner Hunter.
Seems to me that if we're not going to answer the second question, we might as well hold off on the first as well. I'd rather see how that shapes out. And also, maybe it makes a little more sense to be clearer in question two that they are, in fact, separate entities. I mean, I think that's implicit in here, but maybe that would help you as opposed to getting into alter ego and trying to figure out where they're operating and which state laws are we dealing with. Seems like that would be an easier thing to do.
That would be fine with me. Once again, I'm going to have to apologize to Mr. Elias, who has sat here with us for a long time trading hypotheticals and going back and forth, and then we're going to end up asking him to give us a little bit more time.
I don't think you're actually near the end of the 60 days, so that's fine. I mean, it would have been fine anyway, but just so you know, you don't have to. I was surprised at how quickly you had moved this AO. So.
We're trying. We initially thought, I think, that it would be easier to answer than it turned out to be. Some of us find one part of it easy, the other, that as frequently happens, and others of us find the other part easy. But it's I do think this is the most challenging question that we have before us today to answer. I think it's complicated.
I'll just say, for my own sake, I hope so.
Mr. Vice Chairman.
I don't think we can get this done today, frankly. But we may need to write the language over lunch when we have a chance to actually, I don't know, pull a law book off the shelf and see if what we're talking about is true or not. Because, you know, I know enough about corporate law to be dangerous, but I know enough to know to not just hot dog it. Two points. If J&O was really just a DGA that had changed the name on the door, I don't think there's any question that's a problem. I don't think the requester is saying that the requester is not looking for that, right?
In question two, I'm not.
Right, question
two. I actually think question one.
If question one were yes,
then that would be fine.
That's fine. And it kind of moots out.
Until you vote question one, right. I just want to have a standing position that I'm not conceding question one.
Right, I understand that.
Point taken.
In light of that, for purposes of question two, assuming the answer to question one is not the preferred response
correct.
That the requester has sought, if the DGA merely changed the sign on the door to J&O,
that would not fly.
That doesn't work. That's the concern. That this is really just a switcheroo, to use a term that we use in New Jersey.
Term of art.
That I haven't used since about fourth grade. If this were just that, I think we all agree that's not going to get around the Act to the extent the Act applies, and assuming for the sake of argument it does without conceding, let's assume for the sake of argument the Act does apply to the DGA. This requester, I think, would have to agree that.
If you change the name and it was an association of state office holders or candidates, then it would apply.
So the question is the language. I think the chair's suggestion may be correct. I think alter ego is a legal term that is used at least in case law. Whether it's defined with precision, I don't know. Your concern is my concern. are we using a term that we're not really sure what the meaning is? Now, the good news is we've moved off of just sort of saying alter ego, and we're actually tying it to state law. So at least we're tying it to something that in theory has some sort of definition, even if it's through judicial decision.
I will throw out language that maybe everyone goes, aha, we can live with that, and
that's why you're
short-circuit this or not. But what about just saying that has a separate legal is recognized as a separate legal entity under state law? I mean, is recognized by state law as a separate legal entity?
That actually works, because if one were an alter ego under state law, you wouldn't be recognized as a separate legal entity. That your language captures everything.
Right. I assume that that works, because then you're dealing with disregarded entities that are disregarded under law.
Right. Because then if it pierces the veil, then you're not a separate entity, not recognized under state law. That's the whole point of piercing the veil and whether or not you're an alter ego. What was that? One more time.
Recognized as a separate legal entity under state law.
I would like to ponder that. So here's my suggestion, because this is my fault. I should have put this, even though it is numbered 4 and the others are 5, 6, and 7, I should have put this one last. What I would propose is, I know we've been at this for a while, but there are folks here and folks out there who are listening who are interested in the other 3 AOs, which I think will not take nearly as long. So what I would like to do is to try and go to those now. Let's put this.
Any chance you want to just skip to the next one that I have so that I could then be done?
I think the next one will be really quick.
Okay.
So let's go to the next, see if we can get through the other AOs, and then maybe take a break and see if we can agree on some language so that we might actually be able to answer your question, Mr. Elias.
Thank you, and I do appreciate all the time you put in.
Thank you, and my apologies to everybody who was waiting for the other things to happen. We will now turn to the other AOs. And at some point I will actually let people have lunch, but I'm going to ask people to keep going now for a little while. I'm going to call the next item on the agenda, AO 2013-05, from Mr. Gallagly. Mr. Stepanovich.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good afternoon, Commissioners, I guess it is. Agenda Document 1326, response to a request for advisory opinion filed by Representative Elton Gallagly. Representative Gallagly retired from Congress in January 2013 after serving 26 years as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. He has hundreds of boxes of office holder and campaign documents in storage from his many years in Congress that will be sent to California Lutheran University for archiving. He has been reviewing the stored documents since retiring, and so far has reviewed about half of them. Also in storage are a few additional items from his office holder and campaign offices that he intends to eventually dispose of. He has been paying the usual and normal charge of approximately $300 per month to store all of these materials in a commercial public storage facility, and will continue to do so. He plans to complete his review of the documents and dispose of all of the items in storage by the end of calendar year 2013. Representative Gallagly asks whether he may use campaign funds to pay costs associated with the temporary storage of the items pending their final disposition after his retirement from federal office. Agenda Document 1326 concludes that he may do so because the cost is an ordinary and necessary expense incurred in connection with his duties as a holder of federal office and is not personal use of campaign funds. The Commission received no comments on the advisory opinion request or the advisory opinion draft. I'll be happy to address any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have any questions for counsel or discussion on the draft? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't really have much in the way of discussion or any questions for counsel. Appreciate the thorough introduction. There's one draft before us, and I move that we adopt that draft.
Thank you. Vice Chairman has moved approval of the draft advisory opinion 2013-05. to former Representative Gallagher, and authorizing any technical and conforming edits. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, I will call the question. All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. See, Mr. Elias, I told you that wouldn't take long. I'm not sure yet. We'll find out. But feel free to sit there if you like, just in case. The next item. Yeah, okay. I'm informed that there will be questions. The next item on the agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-06 from the DSCC. Completely different client of Mr. Elias's. Ms. Selikoff.
Thank you, Chair Weintraub. Good afternoon. Agenda document 13-30 is a draft advisory opinion in response to three questions from the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee concerning how the terms spouse and family apply to legally married same-sex spouses. On the first question, the draft concludes that DSCC may apply the spouse contribution rule at 11 CFR 110.1I to contributions it receives from legally married same-sex spouses because same-sex couples married under state law are spouses. On the second question, the draft concludes that a Senate candidate who is legally married to a same-sex spouse may utilize jointly owned assets under two provisions of the Commission's regulations under the same conditions as a Senate candidate who is married to an opposite-sex spouse. Finally, on the final question, the draft concludes that DSCC representatives may appear at restricted class events under 11 CFR 114.3C2, at which legally married same-sex spouses are present as families of other restricted class members. The Commission received one comment on the draft, and if the Commission approves the draft, the Office of General Counsel asks for authority to make technical and conforming changes to the final document. I'm available for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Selikoff. And I do want to note that the Windsor decision came down on June 26th, and within a week we had two advisory opinions requests that came in from yourself, and then the next one that we're going to consider. And here we are on July 25th, less than a month later, and we've got them on the agenda, and I'm optimistic we're going to be able to issue those opinions. So I just want to give us a little pat on the back for we always try when people ask for expedited consideration to get the advisory opinion done within a month, and it looks like we'll be able to do that in this case. And thank you for providing us with another interesting question, Mr. Elias. Does anyone have questions for our counsel or Mr. Elias or comments on the draft? Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. A couple questions for Mr. Elias. This is a pretty big issue nationally. A lot of media coverage. Your client agrees it's an important issue.
My client and I both agree this is an important issue, yes. My client agrees it's an important
issue. Given the importance of the issue, should we really decide it now?
Yes. The fact is, we submitted comments, Perkins Coie, we submitted comments when candidate Winslow, I believe it was, submitted a request suggesting that you not take the action you took there. If there was a time where you should have moved more slowly and more deliberately, it would have been when the U.S. Supreme Court was had it pending before them. The U.S. Supreme Court has now decided the case that was pending at the time that you decided Winslow, and I think this is a matter of basic fundamental constitutional rights of U.S. citizens. It is the right of them to contribute and express their First Amendment right to support candidates of their choice. And I think that all the commissioners, especially many of my friends on this side of the dais, are very, very strong supporters to make sure that people do not lose constitutional rights to participate in the political process because of the federal, because the federal government has failed to move or move expeditiously. So I would urge you to, I actually tweeted to the chair's point, I actually tweeted the day of the decision that I thought the commission should just on its own initiative just issue a statement that day vitiating the past advisory opinion and announcing this as policy. I don't want to get into the APA reasons whether you could or couldn't have done that, but I couldn't feel more strongly that this should be. You're talking about the rights of U.S. citizens to contribute funds to support candidates of choice, and that is a First Amendment right that all of you have fought for and which we all support, and I think you should move expeditiously, yes.
Well, my point, that tweet.
My point, though, is that we only have five commissioners, and there's been new nominations. So on important issues, I'm being very serious. Should we wait?
I don't believe you should wait.
Okay. Even though we only have five commissioners, and I think, announced I'm eventually going to leave, and that there's nominees,
I think if I, you, all five of you have been appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate, as I understand the law, you serve until your term has expired and you've been replaced. So you're all properly in the role. And if the commission obtains four votes for an advisory opinion, you should rule and issue the advisory opinion.
So it's okay that I vote on this.
I hope you vote, and I hope on both of these matters you vote in favor of the position that we've urged, and in this case I hope you drop I think what is the only draft, right?
Thank you. We have one draft, Madam
one
Chair.
Draft.
Okay. I don't know. Only five commissioners. A lot of people say that's a problem. So, I appreciate you clarifying that it's not a problem. I move that we adopt the one draft before us.
Vice Chairman has moved approval of Draft Advisory Opinion 2013-06, DSCC. I am hopeful that everyone on the commission will be in consensus on this, and that would be a good thing. I appreciate the comment that you filed last time on the next requester's request, and we felt constrained at that time by DOMA. As we indicated at the time, several of us were not very happy that we felt so constrained, but we did. I can, if this passes, I will take much greater satisfaction in signing this advisory opinion, I can assure you. I did want to say a word about the comment. We did receive a comment asking us to include civil unions. The comment didn't come from somebody who's sort of within our normal circle of commenters, which is always great to hear from other folks, but, you know, for the benefit of that person, anybody else who might be listening and may not be as in the weeds on our normal practice here, we don't normally allow commenters to add to the questions that have been posed to us by requesters. You are the master of your own question. You get to ask the question that you want to ask. And if somebody else, it happens sometimes that commenters will send us something and say, hey, while you're in the neighborhood, why don't you also opine on this? We don't generally do that in our lawyers haven't done any analysis of that particular question. Obviously, somebody could submit that question, and the commission would consider it at that time. I'll just say, I'm just speaking off the cuff here for one commissioner. I would think that if state law defines the partners in a civil union as having all the same legal rights as married people, then we would treat them the same way as well. But that's just one commissioner's off-the-cuff point of view. It's obviously not a formal opinion from the commission. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you. We did a little research into the spouse issue, and part of it was a reaction to the comment. And you're right, the requester is the master of the request, and maybe someone will come in with a request putting the question the commenter raises before us. But the commission has never really concerned itself all that much with the details of being married. And when this came up before, prior to the Supreme Court decision striking the one provision of DOMA that really dictated the answer last time, I made the point that for years and years and years and years and years and years and years, I think back from since 1987, the regs have permitted reattribution and redesignation of contributions among folks with joint bank accounts, married or otherwise. You didn't even have to be married, and you could still get the benefit of writing one check. And the question then, the response to that was, well, okay, that's true, but if you have separate checking accounts, it's not so easy, and that sort of thing. And I guess so. When I did some research, it's interesting because you do have situations where, you know, there's common law marriage. Certain states recognize if you live together for more than 7 years, you're married. I don't think the commission's ever cared to really go in and sort of take discovery on when you actually start living together. I don't think there's ever been a murder on common law marriage, but I don't want to give anyone any ideas. Apparently, West Virginia has a law. I believe it's West Virginia on cousins getting married. And whether or not – it's not up to the commission to decide whether or not that's okay under state law. It's just not our place. I mean, my point is it seems like a new issue, but it's really not for purposes of FICA. For purposes of FICA, it comes down as a request or much more a First Amendment issue, being able to contribute what the limits are. And really, I still come back to a lot of this is a hyper-technical creation of the commission as to how you allocate – contributions among people, whether they're married or not married, or whether they're married under one state's law, but a civil union in another state, or whatever one wants to call it, whether even for business purposes they're some sort of partnership, and how do you attribute it among partners? Something the commission's grappled with for years. And the point I want to make is, forever and a day, the commission has not worried all that much about the details. And I hope in the future the commission continues to take that approach and doesn't get into new details simply because they may or may not like the new details. So for me, I do see it much more as a it's really a hyper-technical regulatory issue, and I say that without trying to trivialize the underlying charged passions on either side. End of the day, we're talking about how you break down a contribution on an FEC report. On the one hand, folks can look at this AO as some bold step. On the other hand, you can look at it as this is the FEC just reading the law and doing what it always does, which is to just try to make sense of the system that we've inherited. So I just wanted to say that, you know, again, not to trivialize anything, but last time it came up, I made the point that for the most part, you can already do this. And now this makes it more clear that you can already do this. And this is so purposes of campaign finance law and limits, everybody counts here.
I'm pleased to agree with everything that the Vice Chairman just said. Any other comments on the draft or the motion? Hearing none, I will call the question. Just to remind everyone, the Vice Chairman has moved approval of draft advisory opinion 2013-06 from the DSCC and authorized technical and conforming amendments for council, by council. All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries 5-0. And that leads us to the next advisory opinion from Mr. Winslow. As we say, Winslow 2, draft advisory opinion 2013-07. Ms. Selenkoff, for reasons that are obvious to me, I guess you have both of these.
Indeed. And those reasons are that Mr. Winslow, who was a candidate in the April 30th Massachusetts special primary election for U.S. Senate, has a committee, Dan Winslow for U.S. Senate Committee, that has submitted an advisory opinion request. Agenda document 13-27 is a draft responding to that advisory opinion request. The committee is actively raising contributions to retire outstanding debts, and like the first question in the DSEC advisory opinion that was just approved, Mr. Winslow asks whether his committee may apply the spouse contribution rule at 11 CFR 110.1I to contributions it receives from legally married same-sex spouses. The draft concludes the committee may. The commission received one comment on the draft, and again, if the commission approves this draft, the Office of General Counsel requests authority to make technical and conforming changes to the final document. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Zelenkoff. Are there any questions for counsel or comments on the draft? Mr. Vice Chairman.
I don't have any comments, but to get the ball rolling, I move we adopt the one draft that's before us.
Thank you. The Vice Chairman has moved approval of AO 2013-07 from Mr. Winslow. I just want to make one comment on the comment that we received this time from someone who asked us to consider the question of someone who's married in one state and moves in a where same-sex marriage is allowed but resides in a state where it's not. And again, we're only answering the question that was posed to us by the requester who apparently was married in Massachusetts and lives in Massachusetts. But for a lot of the same reasons that the Vice Chairman just mentioned with respect to the other AO, you know, we don't usually inquire into the details of these things. And I read the language, the commission concludes same-sex couples married under state law are spouses for the purpose of commission regulations. If you were married under state law, you're married under state law as far as I'm concerned. Again, answering the question that is before us from this particular requester, and we do have one draft, and approval has been moved. Are there any further comments or questions on the motion? Commissioner Hunter.
As part of the motion for technical and conforming changes, could we please include the fact that there's been a more recent report, so the numbers reflected on page one of the draft have changed since we drafted it?
We'll do that.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Noti, and thank you, Commissioner Hunter, for pointing that out. So the motion is to approve draft advisory opinion 2013-07 with technical and conforming amendments, including correcting the current numbers in the last sentence on page one. Any other discussion? In that case, I'll call the question. All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries 5-0. I would suggest at this point, and I appreciate everyone's indulgence in carrying through, that maybe we should take a lunch break and take a look at the state law. And are we looking at D.C. law? Is that where your group is incorporated, Mr. Elias?
Not incorporated.
Established. Okay. Established. Okay. So maybe we'll take a look at D.C. law and see if that provides any inspiration for us. Come back. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Just for fun, maybe we look at Virginia law, too, because if D.C. doesn't quite work, maybe we just want to go across the bridge. You know?
Why not?
We might can be look more freedom over that way.
We can look at Virginia as well. So let's take a break for lunch and a little bit of research and see if we can answer Mr. Elias's question when we come back at 2:15. Okay, we are in recess until 2:15.
Steve Walker.
Hello. Is this working? Okay, good. The open meeting for the Federal Election Commission open meeting for Thursday, July 25th, 2013 is now back from recess. Over the recess, we've had some discussions about draft advisory. Draft advisory opinion 2013-04 and decided that we would like to think about that a little bit more, so we're going to hold over discussion of that. Which brings us to Ms. Orok. Are there any management or administrative matters, Mr. Vice Chairman?
Before we get to that, I have a point of personal privilege.
Sure.
Thank you. I wanted to say a few words about Joan Akins. Joan, we've lost one of our own recently. Longtime FEC commissioner and former chairman Joan Akins passed away at her home Saturday morning. She was 85 years old. She was one of the original members of the FEC. Commissioner Akins was first appointed in 1975. Following the reconstitution of the FEC that resulted from the Supreme Court's Buckley versus Vallejo decision, President Ford reappointed her to a five-year term. In 1981, President Ronald Reagan named Commissioner Akins to complete a term left open because of another resignation, and in 1983, once again reappointed her to a full six-year term. Most recently, Commissioner Akins was reappointed by President Bush in 1989. She served as FEC chairman in 1978, 1986, and 1992, and during the first 8 months of 1998 before retiring on September 18th of that year. A number of commission staff have submitted a variety of very, very nice things about Joan. I'd like to share a few of them. I'll keep the staff anonymous. One staffer remembers Joan as a kind and hardworking commissioner. She remembers Akins as a, quote, a classy lady, and recalled how the former commissioner dressed up as Santa Claus, beard and all, to spread some cheer during the agency's holiday parties. Another staffer said that when Commissioner Akins was at the commission, this staffer worked here and remembers Akins being very supportive of RAD staff and other staff at the commission. This staffer said that she admired her professionalism and positive representation of women in her role as commissioner. She was a class act, always very professional and appreciative of staff, no matter at what level. Someone who worked for me briefly, Ann Real, worked for Commissioner Akins for a very long time. And Ann remembers the commissioner as a wonderful intellectual and very charismatic woman who was committed to fulfilling the commission's mission. Ann added, Joan was even more committed to the wonderful men and women of the FEC with whom she worked for 23 years. She considered every staff member at the commission a part of her family and was deeply concerned with their well-being. I know that she will be missed by the many people whose lives she touched. Before her 1975 appointment, Commissioner Akins was an executive with Lou Hodges Communications, a public relations firm in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania. She was also a member of the Pennsylvania Republican State Committee, president of the Pennsylvania Council of Republican Women, and on the board of directors of the National Federation of Republican Women. A native of Delaware County, Pennsylvania, Commissioner Akins was active in a variety of volunteer organizations and was a member of the Commonwealth Board of the Medical College of Pennsylvania and a past president of Executive Women in Government. She was a member of the board of directors of Ursinus College, where she received her BA degree and honorary Doctor of Law degree. Personal note, she was a commissioner when I first started practicing this area and didn't actually appear before her because people rarely appear before the commission, but certainly had representation while she was a commissioner and always found her to be very fair and certainly someone that I look to as a role model in many ways. I appreciate the opportunity to point a personal privilege on this.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. I really appreciate your sharing those kind words about former Commissioner and former Chair Akin. I didn't know her personally. I mean, I met her a couple of times when she came back to visit, and I know the staff thought very highly of her. But thank you for that. Ms. Orok, are there any management and administrative matters?
There are none.
In that case, this meeting is adjourned.